Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Nicole Hannah-Jones, an investigative reporter at the New York Times Magazine, has the most personal of experiences with this. As a kid, she was bused to a high-achieving public school in Waterloo, Iowa, where she was one of only a few kids of color. As a mother, she and her husband faced an agonizing choice: put her daughter in the struggling public school in her racially and income-diverse New York neighborhood, or send her daughter out of the neighborhood to a higher performing and, yes, less diverse public school. Nicole wrote about the experience for the New York Times, and as she joins us, I think your thoughts on this would be really valuable, particularly if you spotted the Star Tribune's reporting on families of color leaving Minneapolis public schools. Are you one of the families who has had to make this choice, keep your kids in a racially and income diverse school, even though the school may not have superior academic credentials? Or have you put your kids in public schools or charter schools outside, or even private schools outside of your neighborhood? Talk to me a bit about that decision. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. I'm on Twitter at Carrie, KERRIMPR. Nicole Hannah-Jones is a journalist for The Times, and her story is headlined, "Choosing a School for My Daughter in a Segregated City." And she joins us today from New York. And Nicole, welcome to the show. It's good to have you here.
Thank you for having me on.
I have to say, I think your own experience in Waterloo, Iowa is a pretty essential part of the story. You know what it is to leave the familiarity of a neighborhood to, as you write, be visitors in someone else's neighborhood. Tell us a bit about that experience in Iowa.
Sure. So I grew up in Waterloo, Iowa, which is a very blue-collar town, very racially diverse, and has the largest percentage black population in the state of Iowa. It's actually only about 4 hours down Highway 63 from Minneapolis.
That's right.
And there was a large enough black population that the schools on my side of town were segregated. And I began my academic career in a very heavily black, high poverty school. And starting in the second grade, my parents enrolled me in what was a program that was called open enrollment, which was a voluntary desegregation program that the public schools in my hometown implemented under pressure from the Department of Education in the 1970s. And so that allowed me to be bused into an almost entirely white school. And I was bused as part of a desegregation program from second grade until the 12th grade. And I think, the experience was great academically, and it was very challenging socially. And so I do have a very clear and personal understanding of both the benefits and the difficulties of desegregation.
One of the things that you write about that part of your life in the piece is that you do remember being academically challenged, and that was really exciting. But you also remember being exposed to different kinds of people with different kinds of backgrounds and different kinds of experiences and ambitions. And you say in the piece, "I understood that my school friends' parents weren't better than my neighborhood friends' parents, who worked hard every day at hourly jobs. But this exposure helped me imagine possibilities, a course for myself that I had not considered before." Do you remember what that was like, that realization?
I do. As you just read, all of the families I knew from my neighborhood worked very hard, but they worked in particular types of jobs. Most of them were working in the meatpacking plants or other factory jobs, very physically grueling jobs. And when I started getting bused to the other side of town was the first time I met kids whose parents had more white-collar jobs, kids whose parents were lawyers or doctors. And I was in a talented and gifted program, so I was definitely in a class with some of the most affluent kids in my school. And I just, it was the first time that I hung out in the homes of kids whose parents did that type of work. And it wasn't, again, that I mean, even back then, I could see clearly it wasn't that those parents worked hard and the parents in my neighborhood did not, but it was just a completely different type of work than what I was exposed to.
Do you remember your parents talking to you about that, about what it meant that you were leaving the neighborhood, going somewhere else, having these experiences, and coming back and trying to make sense of that? Did they talk openly with you about this?
Not that I remember. I don't remember, or, you know, I wasn't privy to how the decision was made to enroll us in the open enrollment program. And when I talked to my mother about it a couple years ago when I started writing this story, that was really the first time I'd ever had a conversation with either of my parents about the decision.
Wow.
I was in second grade, and I was a kid like any other kid. I went where my parents told me to go, and I didn't question it. I just knew I went from having a very short bus ride to a very long bus ride, and I went from going to a school with kids from my neighborhood to going to a school where most of the kids, I didn't live around them. But my parents never explained to me why they did it. They never talked to me about doing it. They just did it, and I just accepted it because that's what kids do.
You know, I kind of feel like it was suggested in your piece that you don't know if the course that you are now on, right, working for the New York Times, having the kind of career that you have, would have been fully available to you had your parents not made this decision. How do you think about that?
I mean, I think that what we know and what I've spent my career chronicling is that schools that are segregated, particularly black students who are segregated in racially isolated schools and high poverty schools, just do not receive the same education. It just, you know, there's nowhere in the country where kids, black kids segregated away from white kids in high poverty schools get the same type of education and resources that white children get. And so you could be, you know, a very smart child, and if you're not getting the education, I think your chances, and the research shows this, there's actually been longitudinal studies that have tracked black kids who have gone through desegregated schools into their adulthood, and just shows that their results are not the same. That black kids who have the opportunity to go to desegregated schools are more likely to go to college. They are more likely to graduate. They're more likely to have not live in poverty. They're less likely to go to jail. So I don't think at the individual level, one could ever predict exactly what would have happened to someone. But
right.
I certainly know that getting access to the best public education in my town provided certainly set me on the path to get where I am, and that it would have been much, much more challenging to get into the type of college I got into to have succeeded had I been stuck in my segregated schools.
This, of course, is what makes what you and your husband faced as a decision with your daughter particularly interesting. You had the choice of putting your daughter in a school close to the neighborhood, Bedford-Stuyvesant, that you live in New York City. You also had the choice of sending her to a school outside of the neighborhood. How did you and your husband talk about what you were going to do?
So I should be clear. So I live in a very segregated black neighborhood, and the schools are a reflection of that. So the neighborhood schools are almost entirely black and Latino and almost entirely poor. In New York, most affluent or middle-class parents will either test their children for talented and gifted to get them out of their neighborhood schools or enroll their kids in another type of school to get them out of these schools. I knew very early on that I was not going to exercise that option for my daughter, that I wasn't going to write about school segregation and how parents are making choices that maintain segregation and then make that same choice for my child. But as the article notes, that was a bit of a surprise to my husband, who
yes.
Didn't plan. You know, I mean, few people know better than me the harms of a segregated school. And he was a military brat. He never attended a segregated public school in his life because he went to schools on base or that served the base. And, of course, all parents hope to provide a better opportunity for their own children than they had. And so it was not his ideal to send our child to a segregated school. But I believed strongly that parents like myself have to be willing to go into these schools, or we're just then doing our part to sustain inequality and really being hypocritical, I think.
I think your husband's initial reaction to sending your daughter to this school in your neighborhood is going to sound pretty understandable to a lot of people. He says, he asks you, are we experimenting with our child based on our idealism about public schools? That's a really fair question. What else did he ask you about that?
I mean, it is a fair question. He had the concerns that most parents have, and I mean most parents, including parents who are stuck in those schools, have, which is that if you make a decision to put your child in a segregated school, are you depriving your child of the opportunity to get a good education? And the truth is, yes, often you are. But I think my work is making a moral argument. My work is saying that you cannot say you believe in equality and then say that these schools aren't good enough for my own children, but they're good enough for all the children that they're educating. I personally could not make that decision, that if the neighborhood schools are so terrible or the segregated schools are so terrible that we are afraid that our own children can't get an education, then why are we educating any children in those schools? And I think fundamentally that's the question that we have to grapple with, is how do we, as parents and as community members and as policy members, sustain a system where there are certain schools that we would never put our own children in, but those schools are educating someone's children, and the children that are being educated in those schools are the least advantaged. So my daughter, you know, I work at the New York Times. I have a master's degree. My daughter has every possible advantage, and that as a middle-class parent, I'm somehow saying she should get this one too, that in the public system, she should get this one, where that is not going to make as big of a difference for my child as it will for a poor child, where the only advantage, perhaps the only means of getting out of their circumstance, are public schools. And we're saying to that child that we're not even going to give you that. We're going to take every advantage on top of all the advantages that we have. And I say that that is fundamentally immoral. And a lot of parents don't want to hear that. And I guess what I would say to that is, don't say you believe in equality then, because you actually don't. You can't have equality and advantage at the same time.
I mean, Nicole, you are so walking the talk. You absolutely have the high moral ground. But I also understand your husband in saying this is a big, complicated issue that we are not going to be able to solve. And it may take years to solve. Why does our daughter have to be sacrificed on the hill of your moral high ground?
Whose kids should be sacrificed then?
That would be your answer to him.
That's my answer to everyone who asks me that same question, whose children should be sacrificed? Because what we are saying is that someone's children should be sacrificed, just not ours, because we have the ability to remove our children from those circumstances. So that's fine, but then let's not ignore what that means. And that means that the children who have the least are the ones who will be sacrificed. I'm not willing to make that choice. And I think it should also be clear, my daughter is doing great. My daughter is not being sacrificed. Anything that she doesn't get in school, I can give her. And wealthy parents supplement their children's education all the time. Mm-hmm. She's doing fine, and much more importantly than, you know, how high are her test scores, is she is learning to be a good person. She is learning that every child is not as lucky as she is. She's learning what it means to have kids who have to be resilient, who have to struggle through things that she doesn't have to struggle through, and to have compassion. She's not growing up in a bubble where every kid's life is as easy as hers. She's learning that kids who come from the housing project are just as smart as she is. These are all advantages to me.
That sounds really valuable. It does. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
It is valuable. And it's not, believe me, it's not easy. And I try to be very honest in the piece that I have my moments of doubt. I still have my moments of doubt. But if we somehow believe that you end equality without any sacrifice, I think we're either being willfully naive. We know that that's not possible.
If you've just tuned into the conversation, you've heard Nicole Hannah-Jones with us, a reporter from the New York Times, who wrote this great piece about a decision that she had to make about where to put their young daughter into a public school. The option of putting their daughter in a school outside of their neighborhood, where the neighborhood school was underperforming and mostly African-American and Latino kids, and the discussion that went back and forth between she and her husband, and how that ties in with her own childhood experience in Waterloo, Iowa, and the ideas and ideals that she and her husband brought to this conversation as well. And I'm asking you, as you listen into this, whether you're a family who has had to make this choice. And I'd be interested in hearing about how that discussion, whether you put your children in schools outside of the neighborhood because you were very concerned about the academic performance, how you feel about that decision. 651-227-6000. I'll tell you that Nicole can only stay with us for about another 15 minutes or so. So if you're going to call in, now's a good time. 800-242-2828 and on Twitter at @CarrieNPR. Nicole, I want to ask you about something maybe a little unusual that's going on in Minneapolis-St. Paul, and you might be aware of that. You know that we have the widest achievement gap in the country between white students and students of color.
Yes.
As African-American families in Minneapolis are now permitted to use open enrollment, they're moving their kids out of these often segregated inner-city schools to schools outside of their neighborhoods and outside of the district. What do you think of that?
Well, let's be clear. The issue of school segregation and school inequality, the fix for that can't be born or should not be expected to be born by black families who have been generationally deprived of a quality education. I think we need to be very clear about where the long-term advantages have lain. And so to ask that black parents who, you know, we know do not have the wealth of white parents, who do not have the resources of white parents, who often are the first generation in the middle class. And what the data shows is that of all racial groups, black families have the most precarious foothold on the middle class, and that their children are actually the most likely to fall back out of the middle class than other kids. Mm-hmm. Then we can't expect that they have to bear the cost of trying to desegregate schools. So I think absolutely if black parents feel like they have to leave their neighborhood schools to get a quality education for their children, they should. The fix for this has to be born by white families. It simply does. Segregation exists because that's what white families want. White families are the ones who have benefited from segregation and who have created the segregation and who maintain the segregation. And so it is going to have to be white families who are willing to give up something, and we can't place that burden on black families.
So,
I mean, I made my choice, but I don't expect that other black families who have been generationally deprived of a quality education should make that sacrifice. They shouldn't have to.
Let me get some calls in here to Ben in Eagan. Hi, Ben. What's your situation with this?
I have a son. We live in a first tier suburb, and a lot of the kids from St. Paul and are coming into our district, and it's a very, very integrated district. We always get the question. We always see families leaving to go out to Matamidi or White Bear Lake,
right?
And they just want to get out there. But I choose to stay. I have a white son, and we want to stay because there's so many differing perspectives and so many different kids coming from different areas that when we're staying in our integrated first ring suburb school, we're getting a specific education here socially because we're seeing things from everyone's different perspective. We might not have all the money that a school from way out in the suburbs might have, but we're choosing to, kind of in the words of your speaker, kind of sacrifice my son's possible different education so he can stay within a completely sort of integrated environment in an integrated school to get that social education.
Ben,
thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, I really appreciate hearing about how this works in your family. I want to hear from Jessica in Minneapolis. Jessica, also a conversation about this in your household?
Yeah, exactly. We actually moved to Plymouth from North Minneapolis to get out of the Minneapolis public schools, but then went into Robbinsdale, and we were faced with the decision that the homeschool that our kids would go to was one of the lower test scoring ones. And at first it was very difficult, but it was very culturally diverse, ability diverse, and it was the best decision we made because my daughter has friends from all races, from all abilities, and she's really, as your caller has, or your guest, excuse me, has pointed out, just she's learning how to deal with the diversity in the world. And to us, we could supplement education so much more at home than we can cultural experiences. So we actually turned down the open enrollment option for the highest test scoring school in our district and stuck with this more culturally diverse one because we do want to help get rid of this racism in our culture. And
Jessica, I think I heard you say at the beginning, though, that you left North Minneapolis to get out of the Minneapolis school district. Is that right?
Yeah, correct. Because we at first moved under that, you know, I guess misconception that we need to go to the best school districts. But we were rushed because we wanted to try to move into a different school district before kindergarten. And then we found ourselves kind of in the same situation. But really, it turned out to be one of the better ones. Mm.
Okay, thanks very much for the call. And Nicole, what do you hear in both of those parents' decisions?
I mean, one, I think it's important to say that test scores are actually, well, one, white students' test scores do not go down in integrated or even heavily black schools. So these fears about somehow their test scores will drop actually are not borne out by facts. But also, test scores are such a small measure of the education that children are receiving and the quality of instruction and the quality of a school. But this is a thing that we seem very obsessed with when really test scores just track the racial and socioeconomic demographics of the school. If you put a bunch of white kids in the school, test scores go up. If you disaggregate, white students' test scores pretty much stay the same no matter the type of school that they're in. But I also think what is considered a diverse or integrated school is very relative. And I don't know the particular demographics of the schools that your callers are calling from, but I would imagine they have a very small black population. And that overall, even the schools that people are considering to be very diverse are really often not that diverse compared to, for instance, the Minneapolis public schools.
I have to say, I thought what you talked with sociologist Amy Stuart Wells about for your piece was mm-hmm. super interesting. In fact, I'd like to have her on the show. She talked to you about how suburban parents choose a school and what they say when they're mm-hmm. choosing a school. And she said, while race and poverty are obviously the subtext, parents will say, well, look at the test scores. Our kids couldn't possibly go there. What are they
right?
What are they really saying, Nicole?
I mean, what she actually showed is that they will go to a lower test score school if it is a whiter school.
Uh-huh.
And so while parents, you know, it is perfectly acceptable to say, I don't want to go to a school with low test scores. But of course, test scores are a proxy for race. It is not acceptable to say, I don't want to go to a school with a lot of black or brown kids. So parents will say that they're choosing a school based on test scores. But what the research has shown is that they're actually choosing schools based on race, and that you can have a school that is more heavily black and has higher test scores, and they're going to choose the white school.
And it's not really test scores. Her reasoning for that, or her conclusion, I should say, about that is what? Just a bunch of stereotypes about what it means to be in a school where you have a lot of African-American kids and Latino kids. Is that it?
Absolutely. I mean, race is still a primary driver in both our personal interactions and our public policy. And I think we would like to pretend that it isn't, but it just absolutely is. When I wrote the story about my daughter's school and making that decision, one of the things that I got constant feedback on was, how dare you put your daughter in a school that's not safe? I never mentioned that my daughter's school was not safe, and it
that's
is
right,
safe,
you didn't.
And I clearly wouldn't enroll my child anywhere where I felt she would be physically harmed. But the automatic assumption was, because this was a school of poor Black kids, it is an unsafe school. And that is a difficult thing to fight, because that is almost intrinsic in how we think about Black kids, and particularly Black kids in poverty.
That's really interesting, because what I took away from your description of PS 307, that's the school, right? Public mm-hmm. School 307. You mentioned how imaginative and creative the principal is at that
yes.
school. And I thought, boy, Nicole is lucky. She has a school right in her neighborhood where you've got this principal doing these really unique things to maybe overcome some of the things that Nicole and her husband were concerned about.
You know, what was so interesting is this school, so it was a STEM magnet, so a science, technology, engineering, math magnet school.
Mm-hmm.
The principal had brought in extra funding, so my daughter got art. She was learning Mandarin. They had a music teacher. All of these things that the neighboring school, I mean, part of the story for the listeners who haven't read it was our school was under-enrolled. There was a school about a mile away that was majority white and very overcrowded, and the school district decided that it was going to rezone some of those white students to our school because they had a capacity problem. And that school, because it was so overcrowded, had been stripped of everything extra. There wasn't a music room anymore. There wasn't a room for a chorus or drama anymore. They didn't offer foreign language, none of the things that my daughter's school offered. And at the public meetings, parent after parent from the white school would get up and say, you know, that school is under-resourced and deprived, and they're not going to get the same thing that our kids get, when actually our kids were getting more things than their kids got.
Hmm.
But again, you know, none of them took the time to come into the school. None of them took, and some of them lived across the street from the school. None of them took the time to actually observe and see what type of education was being offered, to research the school. The assumption is, if it's a poor Black school, it's not good enough for our kids, and it clearly can't be offering anything that would benefit our children. And people are, I mean, we all know this, people are writing off schools without ever having stepped a foot in the door, because they know who are the kids who sit in the classrooms. And I think we need to acknowledge that.
Do you have time for one more call?
Sure.
Let me grab Ricardo in Minneapolis. Hey, Ricardo. Hi. Thanks so much for waiting.
Hi. And I apologize. I am in my commute into the office, but I stopped for a second.
Okay. Good. So, what do you want to say to Nicole?
Well, my wife and I have been struggling with this. I'm a Latino man. My wife is white, and we chose to stay in our community school. We live on the south side of Minneapolis. Both of us are educators, and we see seen so many issues in the school, and we've been very torn. That being said, we chose to stay even after having a really tough first year with our child, our
mm-hmm.
firstborn. And I've talked with other families like that are, frankly, we don't make as much money as most of the people that we associate with. And they either bought houses in areas where they knew the schools were quote unquote good, or they have chosen to put their children in schools in other neighborhoods, and it's been a really difficult personal journey for the two of us, but also really difficult in hearing our friends, you know, many of them white and affluent, who have made these other decisions. And seeing the schools and the communities that they've chosen to either not live in or leave, they struggle, they fail, and I was really moved by what you said that it's not up to the Black families. And I missed the first part of the conversation, but for me this isn't just a Black issue; it's a Latino issue, it's a Native issue,
absolutely.
It's that whole question of other. And it is. It's up to those families to not only keep their kids in there for the test score. You know, like I get the test score argument is really frightening to me, but also to advocate for a better school and to do it in a way that benefits all students.
Ricardo, so
absolutely.
Glad you heard that. Go ahead, Nicole, for a thought on that.
Well, I would just I think before I go, I should make it clear that I'm not saying there will be no sacrifice. I think what affluent and white parents want if they choose to go into one of these schools is they want it to function just like the white affluent schools function. And the truth is they often don't. If they did, segregation wouldn't be a problem. So I think, you know, I can't say every minute of my daughter's time in her school has been easy. I can't say there have been no problems. I can't say that we haven't been frustrated. But that's kind of the point, is we have to go into those schools because those schools get ignored. The parents don't have the same power that we have to fix things and to demand things. And there is going to be a sacrifice. But I also think that the benefits, not just for our own children, but for the good of our society, outweigh those things.
Nicole Hannah-Jones's piece for The New York Times is headlined "Choosing a School for My Daughter in a Segregated City," and I'll tweet it out, a link to it, a little later. Nicole, thank you. It sounds like you have a busy day, and I appreciate you fitting us into it. Thanks a lot.
Of course. Thanks for talking about the topic. It's very important.
Absolutely.